Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Today, it's the local news roundup. In a week that lasted about 3 months, a lot happened. You may have heard about shifting stances on tariffs in Washington. North Carolina's senior senator had some strong reservations about those. On a more optimistic note, CMPD released its quarterly crime report, and the numbers are encouraging. International students at UNC Charlotte have had their visas revoked by the federal government. It's part of a troubling trend across the state and the nation. It's budget season for CMS, and teacher pay is back in the news. And finally, does Charlotte's World Cup runneth over? Here to discuss these and other stories are Mary Ramsey. She is local government accountability reporter at the Charlotte Observer. James Farrell is WFAE's education reporter. Hunter Sines is a reporter at WSOC-TV. And Ben Thompson is WCNC's morning and midday anchor. Good morning to you all.
Happy Friday.
Good morning.
Happy Friday. So let's begin with President Trump and his here today, kind of gone tomorrow tariffs. The bond market, S&P 500, and NASDAQ have been roller coasters since the president declared Liberation Day last week with dramatic tariff hikes. And even with a rally of 9.5% Wednesday after the president announced a 90-day delay on many of the tariffs, markets, banks, businesses, and governments around the world remain rattled. Since Trump took office in January, the three main stock indexes have declined by 10% to 17.5% each. Here is how Tom Tillis responded to Trump's tariffs during the Senate hearing with U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer.
Whose throat do I get to choke if this proves to be wrong?
Well, Senator, you can certainly always talk to me, but I
But are you at the tip of the spear?
Well, I'm at the tip of the spear for certainly.
Did you propose the a la prima approach?
So, first of all, I would push back, Senator, just a little bit on this.
So, after Trump partially reversed course Wednesday, Tillis praised the president. He posted on social media that Trump made, quote, the right decision, end quote, and said the U.S. needs to hold China accountable for unfair trade practices. So, Ben, where to begin with the tariffs and Tillis's reaction?
Where to begin is 2026, Tillis is running for re-election. That's where you begin. And I think that sort of informs everything that he does right now. We just saw that he approved all the president's nominees. And we also know that he is a sort of a, whether he would describe this or not, I think most people would say he's the middle of the road conservative right now. And he's been considered the most vulnerable senator up for re-election next year. So he has begged in the last few weeks for a more nuanced approach when it comes to tariffs, instead of what he's referring to in that clip, all at one approach. He's made the argument that, and he did right there in that hearing, that Republicans don't have the luxury of time, that if these sweeping tariffs were to take place, if they get reenacted, say, in 3 months, Republicans have a very finite opportunity to prove their worth before people like himself are going to face re-election next year. He talks about, and he invokes this a lot on the campaign trail, and he did when it comes to this as well, that he talks about that trailer park that he grew up in. And he says, he points out that those are going to be the people who really bear the brunt of some of this short-term cost increase. So I think probably nobody happier about this in the political world in the last few days than Tom Tillis, that appears, at least for the time being, President Trump is backing off some of these tariffs.
What sense do we have of Tillis's view on China? He mentioned in that post holding China accountable, but I wonder if he thinks tariffs of 145% are holding China accountable or going a step too far or three steps too far.
Because even overnight, we saw once again, this happened around 4 a.m. when I first came in this morning, China retaliated already. And so we're seeing already a back and forth. I'm not sure anybody is overly confident about how this is going to turn out right now. But even if you agree with the tariff on China in general, the back and forth is going to have to stop between the two countries at some point.
Mary, I'm curious if you think, you know, Ben is talking a lot about the political implications for Tillis. People have as we know, very short attention spans. Do you think something like this resonates by the time we get to the 2026 campaign?
I don't know that the individual event necessarily will, but I think it can be have a longer term impact when you think about who he might face in 2026. Wiley Nickel has already jumped in on the Democratic side. There's been an incredible amount of talk about the potential of Roy Cooper running on the Democratic side. Tillis also has to be concerned about getting primaried from his right in the Republican Party. So I think anything that can sort of give munition and energy to a potential opponent, whether in a Republican primary or in the general election, is certainly a problem for Tillis, especially in this day and age where election cycles quite simply just start earlier and earlier. The Nickel campaign is already up and running. They are putting out ads about tariffs. So they can certainly make this a problem, or at least try to, for Tillis.
And as we look ahead to 2026, remember that, I'm sure both of you do, Tillis won by 1 point in 2014 and 2 points in 2020. So not exactly blowouts there. It's going to be tight. Hunter, I'm curious. I think you were talking to some area businesses this week about the effects from the tariffs. What are they saying?
We talk about just whiplash back and forth. I don't think anybody can really keep up on the back and forth. Are tariffs going up? Are they going down? And imagine being a small business owner. I mean, take, for instance, a lot of people love a cup of Joe in the morning. I know many of us do here on this show. But one of them was a local coffee shop who said they had bought a year's supply of coffee bags in November. They were already labeled and printed. They got held up in the port come February. They finally get them, okay, but then they get a tariff bill for them after all these tariffs started being enacted. So now with the new announcement, are they going to get a decreased bill on that? They just don't know. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And when you're a business owner that has small margins, like a coffee shop, what do you do? Are you able to hire more staff? Are you able to boost your coffee production when coffee is already expensive from getting the beans sourced in? Another one was the construction industry. I mean, you talk about the real estate boom that we've had here for quite a while now. Well, imagine the construction to go into building these new homes. You're talking about the beams, the HVAC systems, the shingles, the brackets that are, many of them are from other countries. That's going to be an extra cost to those construction companies that we know is going to be likely passed on to the consumer and the people buying those homes.
See, I'm just dying to say that you spilled the beans on that, but I wouldn't do that because that's just a cheap dad joke. So an unusual story this week out of Raleigh, Republican House member Keith Kidwell, who represents the eastern part of the state, has introduced a bill that would ban abortion at conception. The only exception would be if the mother's life is endangered. This comes less than 2 years after the legislature reduce the time for legal abortions to the first 12 weeks of pregnancy from 20 weeks. But everyone in Raleigh says Kidwell's bill has no chance for serious consideration. Here's Speaker Destin Hall.
I don't think there's any real desire in our caucus to hear that particular bill. And so it's not going to be heard in committee. You know, we just passed less than 2 years ago, really landmark pro-life legislation. And that bill did a lot of things, and I think we need to give some more time to see how that bill is working.
So given that sentiment, why are so many people talking about this bill?
I think what you're seeing here is the effect of Donald Trump on the abortion issue. He talked about it at length last year, was proud of what the Supreme Court, which is made up by at least three of his justices, had done in the past when it comes to Roe v. Wade, but was not comfortable going much beyond that. I think what you have here now is going forward, at least in North Carolina, but a lot of people would say across the country, Republicans drawing a real tangible line in the sand for themselves about what they're willing and what they're not willing to do. They've seen the polling on this. They've seen the elections that have happened after the Roe v. Wade decision was changed. And I think they might be saying, hey, we can only go so far in here. And you heard it right there in Destin Hall's voice that he just doesn't feel like there's an appetite for this, not in the General Assembly, but in the Republican caucus within the General Assembly. And you know, it was I think we asked Tim Moore back when this passed 2 years ago, when there were stricter regulations, hey, is this just the beginning or could there be more? At the time, Tim Moore said, we don't know what we're going to do. We can't comment on that. But I don't think Tim Moore at the time could say where we were at as a country, given a couple of election cycles, and this issue being sort of tossed around for several years now.
And, you know, there, even though, again, this bill is not likely to have serious consideration, some of the penalties in it, losing medical license, $100,000 fine, these are serious stakes. And Hunter, I'm curious, given the implications for doctors and others in healthcare already with the changes in abortion law recently, how do you think that is changing conversations with patients?
So there are already concerns when it comes from the medical field with our law that is already on the books, the 12-week ban. You have to think many women don't even know that they're pregnant or get that news until between maybe 4 and 6 weeks. Sometimes it comes even after that. So you're already 6 weeks away if you're going to make that plan for having an abortion. You also have to factor in there's usually a waiting period to get into Planned Parenthood for that type of procedure. Sometimes it's a week. Sometimes it could be longer. When this bill went in, of course, there was a little bit of hysteria because it was so new and such a restriction. Then you have a 72-hour waiting period. So a lot of these patients are getting so close to that 12-week. And it's a serious decision, right? I think it is for everyone. So you're having to make that decision in a small amount of time just to already go by the law. Now, I think this would create a bit more concern in the healthcare community. Like you said, this isn't going anywhere for right now, but in the future, as we continue to talk about the abortion topic, I think there would be concern if this is brought up again.
And you would also think just the specter of this, again, even though it's highly unlikely to pass, but just putting it on the table out there, because we know how politics works. Something may feel extreme today, not so extreme in a year or two. So this is going to, I would think, rattle doctors and other healthcare professionals.
Yeah, and it already has. I mean, they already had to go through changes. You're talking about somebody who goes through years of medical school, of residency, of sometimes a specialty after that. And then you're talking about taking that away when arguably they are doing the job that they were trained to do. So every time this comes up, I think it's going to spark concern in the healthcare community, especially when you're talking about restricting not only the access to the care that a patient once had or the care option that they had, but also you're talking about restricting the duties that were taught to an actual physician.
And I'm going to veer back to where we started. Mary, you mentioned Wiley Nickel. He has announced maybe more than once that he's running, challenging Senator Tillis. But what did he say this week?
Yes. So he is officially, I think this might be the third or fifth time that he has officially announced that he is running officially against Senator Tom Tillis. Obviously, there's been a lot of conversation about another big name Democrat as well, former Governor Roy Cooper, and the potential of a primary fight setting up there on the Democratic side, or even the potential that Nickel could sort of step back into the shadow in order to make way for Cooper if he were to decide to hop in this race. But either way, I think, you know, him getting into it this early and really already putting a concerted effort into fundraising and advertising is a sign of how vulnerable Tillis is and how desperate Democrats are for a win in a seat like this. Democrats have been dying to pick up a Senate seat in North Carolina for a few election cycles now. Republicans continue to eke by, so they're hungry for a win.
With that, we will take a break, but we have much more to discuss. Stay with us right here on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. It's Friday, and that means we are knee-deep in the Local News Roundup. Our panel includes Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, WFAE's very own James Farrell, from WSOC-TV, Hunter Sines, and from WCNC-TV, Ben Thompson. On Thursday, CMPD reported crime statistics for the first quarter, covering January 1st through March 31st. overall crime is down 6% compared to this time last year. Violent crime dropped 17%, and property crime fell 4%. Homicides decreased 38%, with 20 in the first 3 months of the year. And CMPD has recovered more than 900 firearms. CMPD Deputy Chief David Robinson said many of the guns recovered have different owners or are from different locations.
Over half of them are stolen. Stolen out of other jurisdictions or stolen out of this jurisdiction. I urge you, if you own a gun, if you carry a gun legally, lawfully, protect that firearm. It's unconscionable that we have over half the guns that we've seized just in the first quarter come from stolen property.
Hunter, you covered this story. Start with the guns that Deputy Chief was addressing, and then maybe some thoughts on why the police think these numbers are so much better.
Yeah, so on the first hand, we see this time and time again of people still not locking up their guns or taking proper care of their guns, leaving them in unlocked cars or on a seat, and then they're easily accessible to a thief who is going to break in and get them. And time again, a lot of times, whether it's a homicide where these guns pop up at or a robbery, odds are, if you were a betting person, that that gun would be likely stolen. That's how big of a problem it has become. On the second question, they attribute a lot of different programs and efforts that CMPD has. One of them is Core 13, which is the Coordinated Overlap Response Effort. It's basically where CMPD deploys officers in strategic locations from all 13 divisions. And it's really in the areas that have had increased crime or an increased amount of victims calling CMPD. And they're using real-time data, from day to day. So one of these areas is, of course, historically, the Bates Ford and LaSalle area has historically seen quite a bit of crime. And just by using Core 13, along with community efforts, we've seen boots on the ground, anti-violence interrupters. We know that program. We've talked about it before. They have seen a 60% reduction in crime in just the Bates Ford Road and LaSalle corridor. Another one is down in Steel Creek, where they saw a 37% drop near the Archdale area, Archdale Road. So that's just one program that they have kind of alluded to what could be a significant drop in this. But I do want to also just say this is quarter one. This is a moment in time. We still have a long time of the year to go. And the police department knows that. They said they're not letting up on their efforts. They want to double down, even though that crime is technically down right now.
And some of those examples you mentioned, it seemed like that was a theme during the press conference. The explanation of the successes they've had is this combination of community outreach and high-tech analysis of crime spots, how better to get police there and, follow those patterns. Is that kind of what you heard?
Yeah, I heard that. And quite frankly, I think the word of the entire press conference was perception. They kept saying that there is a perception problem when it comes to safety and Charlotte. They argue Charlotte is a safe community, and how, in years past, a lot of us have latched on to homicides are up or crime is up. But finally, we have a quarter in which crime is significantly down. And they believe that this community should feel like it is safe, like CMPD is on top of things. So I can't tell you how many times I heard the word perception in that press conference. They are clearly wanting, businesses don't move here if it's not a safe community. And I think that Charlotte is technically still booming. So I get where they're coming from. But I do just want to still caution that we have a long time to go before we have quarter fours wrap up. So we will see if this continues, if their efforts do continue, which we should, of course, take note. But there has long been an effort, these CMPD chats program, where officers are going in to communities. and trying to figure out what the problems are to residents, whether it's speeding in your neighborhood, blowing through stop signs, crime, break-ins, thefts of your Amazon packages, whatever matters to the community, they're really trying to turn it around and show that they care about those crimes too. And I think it's just more forward-facing, connecting with their quote-unquote customers, because they're in this customer service type of mentality now, CMPD is. So they're trying to fix that perception, and in doing that, they're wanting to explain these numbers of a significant drop.
A couple other things on this. One is, as you were speaking, that reminded me there was some emphasis on the minor crash investigation team and how those, I guess they are officers, I'm not sure, those officers are in place to do that work so that the rest of the officers can get to the more serious crime. That is a relatively new approach.
It's a relatively new approach. Other departments have been able to do this and do it successfully. And we got new numbers. In the first 3 months, they have actually gone out and responded to over 2,000, I think it was close to 3,000 incidents of minor crash. These are not sworn officers. These are trained civilians who do this job, but they have shown success. So when you think about 3,000 calls that an officer during rush hour doesn't have to respond to, can then investigate whatever they need to of a more serious crime in their department or area, they can do that. Another one I'll just add, which I thought was also pretty significant and cool, is you got to think about all the events that Charlotte hosts. Sometimes it's like a soccer game and a Hornets game or a music festival all on the same Saturday. Well, that takes a lot of traffic control. And those are officers that are at those streets trying to direct traffic. Well, they are now expanding their civilian traffic control officer program where they can they train other city employees to come in and do this, which again gets those officers out in their specific areas and focused on solving crime, responding to crime, and it just frees up those services. So that could also be a reason for a decrease in crime, is you're able to actually let them do the jobs that they signed up to do.
Probably a good time for that, since we have the Love & Life Music Festival, 3 stadium concerts, the PGA Championship, and World Cup matches coming up in roughly the next 6 to 8 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. But one other public safety story that you covered this week, Hunter, and that is the problem of street takeovers and racing on city streets. CMPD has had some success breaking up this activity. What are they doing, and what results are they seeing?
So a lot of times when we think about the street takeovers, we've seen the videos online of these massive takeovers, some of them with fireworks, some of them where people have gotten shot, and police arrive and they all scatter. And it's quite hard for CMPD to arrest literally 100 to 200 people. So they will usually arrest just a few and the rest are free to go pretty much. This time, this is the first time that we have seen it. I'm not saying this is the first time they have used this mechanism. It's the first time that I've seen it in court documents, where they have now gone after people's Instagram handles, gotten search warrants to find out who's running those Instagram accounts, and have arrested those people for organizing or promoting these street takeovers online. These are very well coordinated. These are very well planned online, telling people where to be, what time to be on a Saturday night to do these street takeovers. Now they are charging them with a specific portion of the new street takeover law that recently went into effect.
Ben, this week we saw more debate over an issue that has been a controversial topic in Monroe for a couple of years, drag shows and worries that children are at risk from indecent behavior. On Tuesday, Monroe City Council voted 5-2 against defining and regulating drag shows. This stems from shows at East Frank Supperette in downtown Monroe. Councilwoman Julie Thompson said this is a policy that should not be handled by council.
It really isn't fair to the individual sitting here expecting us to vote and define an event we cannot define. And I'm just being honest with you. We cannot define it. There's no law to back it up. If we try to pass it, our police officers can't enforce it. It's not a law. It's not an ordinance.
That's from Queen City News. Ben, why has this been such a hot topic, and is it finally resolved?
Probably not. Who would have thought Monroe, North Carolina, would become sort of ground zero for the debate over drag shows? At issue, really, at the heart of this, is what constitutes adult entertainment, and how can a town enforce that? And by enforce that, I also mean, and you heard the council member allude to this, how can police then enforce it? Because if you're a town, you're going to have a new law on the books or a new ordinance. You want to be make sure that your police can actually enforce it. And I think that's sort of where the sticking point is, because you have a mayor there who's pushing for this and a mayor pro tem who's pushing for this, but then you have council members who appear to come sort of be across the spectrum when it comes to how they feel about this issue, but all come down on the side of, we don't really know that this is in our wheelhouse to pass legislation like this. This might be something for the General Assembly to do or for Congress to do, but Monroe City Council, they're not really clear they have a role in something like this. But to your point, this goes back to, I think, August 2022, when they started having drag bingo, which is a popular format for drag shows, at a couple of places like that. Evidently, at one of them, there was a child that was spotted in the audience and a photo was taken. It went viral. I think since then, the restaurant has agreed to only allow adults into that drag show. So I think that's something else that the city council brought up, is that it appears that these businesses are cooperating with any sort of issue that the city might have. So that brings us to right now. And what happened this week was basically a big impasse of where you've got a council not really being on the same page as the mayor about what's a proper way forward.
We learned this week that at least six international students at UNC Charlotte had their visas unexpectedly revoked. University officials confirmed on Wednesday. The move by the federal government follows similar actions at UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and NC State. Officials at Johnson C. Smith, Winthrop, and the University of South Carolina said none of their students have had their visas revoked to date. But Johnson C. Smith issued a statement saying they are, quote, closely monitoring, end quote, the situation. Here's what UNC Charlotte students told WCNC.
It's heartbreaking because people come here for opportunities and, you know, the American dream, and the American dream is not alive anymore. It's not real. It's not a thing. And so it's heartbreaking.
Just like most people here, I'm second, third generation. Of course, almost nobody in America has been here for more than three generations. For you to just say, like, yeah, you're getting kicked out of the country for what? For your political views? What happened to free speech?
James, what do we know about the UNC Charlotte students who had those visas revoked? Do we know where they are, and do we know what countries they are from?
Yeah, for the UNC Charlotte students, they were from India and Nigeria. At this point, we don't know if they're still in the country. At least that's the last that I had heard. They had their student visas revoked, which doesn't automatically mean you're going to be deported, but I know stories on this have noted that their records were also removed from the student in exchange visitor information system, which usually is a sign that deportation will begin. So it's not entirely clear what their status is right now. And it's also not entirely clear exactly what reasons they were being targeted for this action are. I mean, certainly around the country, we've seen hundreds of similar cases of this. And a lot of times the administration has cited, you know, participation in pro-Palestinian protests that we've seen on college campuses over the last couple of years. But it's unclear if something like that was playing a role in these cases specifically, or what might have motivated this at this point.
And do we think it is inevitable that we're going to see more of this? UNC Charlotte has 3,400 international students. North Carolina as a whole ranks 15th in the United States with more than 24,000 international students. You know, is there any reason to think that we're not going to see more of this?
I don't think there's any reason to think that this is going to slow down at this point. I mean, the administration has kind of doubled down. We just saw that yesterday in court in the case of Mahmoud Khalil from Columbia University. He was somebody who was scheduled for deportation because of his participation in pro-Palestinian protests. There's been a lot of questions about what kind of evidence the U.S. government has to kind of bring forward to create a legal justification for removing him. A court ordered that the federal government had to provide that evidence, and they have kind of continued to try to double down on that. So it doesn't seem the administration is slowing down in its efforts to continue doing this kind of action.
And to your point, on Saturday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said all South Sudanese students in the U.S. would have their visas revoked because of ongoing clashes with that country's government. And this happened the same day that Kaman Malwach, a star basketball player at Duke, was playing for the Blue Devils in the Final Four. He's expected to be a first-round draft pick in this year's NBA draft, and he's from South Sudan. I'm just curious, James, do you think a high-profile athlete such as him could generate more attention to this issue, bring any pressure to slow this down?
Yeah, certainly. I think that could be the case, and especially in a case like that where there's no, again, there's no obvious reason as to why, and that's what you've been hearing from immigration advocates and legal experts who have questioned whether this is, you know, violating due process or, you know, there's no legal justification to do this, and what kind of precedent does that set? When you have a case like that where it's somebody who is high profile, I mean, especially this time of year with the basketball tournament and everything, where there's a lot of visibility on that, certainly it could increase advocacy efforts or increase awareness of what's actually going on. And again, like we just mentioned, especially if this kind of action continues to happen all over the country.
We will certainly keep an eye on that. Mary, you wrote this week about big plans for Symphony Park in South Park. Adam Rue, who is the head of South Park Community Partners, made a presentation to City Council this week about a proposed $21 million makeover. So what is South Park Community Partners and what do they want to do with Symphony Park?
Yeah, so South Park Community Partners is a nonprofit that leads what's called the Municipal Service District in South Park, which is basically a group that's allowed by the city to impose a small additional tax on property within a very specific area, in this case, South Park Mall and the immediate surrounding areas, to generate funds for projects like park renovations. So Symphony Park, which is right on the South Park Mall property, known for hosting its spring and summer concert series and some Charlotte Symphony events, will be getting, under this plan, a $21 million makeover. Plans include two new restaurants, some additional retail space, some renovations to the bandstand, and better connecting the park to the South Park Loop, which is an urban trail in that area that South Park Community Partners is also really eager to expand to improve walkability in the neighborhood.
And does council have to approve this?
So there is an ask for city money within this plan, specifically $8 million. However, the idea is that that money will come from some bond money that has already been sort of earmarked for the South Park area. And when the plan was presented to the City Council's Economic Development Committee this week, there seemed to be a good wealth of support from City Council for signing off on that spending. One question that did come up during that meeting was the role of the county. Mecklenburg County traditionally oversees parks and rec projects. I spoke to County Commissioner Laura Meyer, who said that there are ongoing conversations.
With that, we will have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about light rail. Stay with us on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our discussion on the local news roundup with Mary Ramsey of the Charlotte Observer, Hunter Sines from WSOC, Ben Thompson from WCNC, and WFAE's own James Farrell. The endless story that is transit expansion took a turn this week when Mecklenburg Republican Tricia Cotham filed a bill in the House for a local sales tax referendum, matching the Senate's actions in February and March, but there is one big difference in Cotham's bill that's tied to the Silver Line. Mary, what is that difference and what are the bill's chances?
Yes. So for a long time now, we've been talking about the virtual impossibility of the Silver Line because of the need to cap how much of this new tax revenue could be spent on rail projects in order to appease Republicans in Raleigh. However, Representative Cotham's bill does not include that cap on rail spending. It simply says that if we get this tax increase, 40% of the new money will go to roads and 60% will go to public transit in general. There's no language in her bill that specifies how much of that 60% could be spent on rail, which opens the door for the possibility of some sort of Silver Line affordability. The bill also includes a provision that if a new transit authority is established as part of this overhaul, that transit authority would have to conduct a study on the feasibility of the Silver Line, including looking into additional funding sources to make it happen as light rail, especially going east towards Matthews.
And we should probably mention that 7 of the 8 local government bodies have been behind this. Matthews is the one that hasn't. And Tricia Cotham's district happens to include Matthews. All coincidences, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, this is something when Speaker Destin Hall was in Charlotte on the day that the Senate version of this bill was addressed and asked about Matthews' opposition, he immediately pivoted to Representative Cotham, saying that she has a lot of influence within the Republican caucus and that her opinion on this would hold a lot of sway. So I think it's certainly not bad news for the town of Matthews that her bill specifically includes this. I did reach out to Matthews Mayor John Higdon, who has been the biggest voice opposing this bill locally, or the transit plan in general, I should say. Because of the lack of funding for the Silver Line, he said he was still reviewing Representative Cotham's legislation, but that he remains committed to working with leadership in Raleigh in order to put together a plan that benefits his town.
And the town managers, the other town managers beyond Matthews and business leaders came out immediately on Thursday. So it seems like the support is pretty strong. But that's going to be an interesting reconciliation discussion between the Senate and the House, assuming these two bills move in advance.
Most definitely, yeah. It was a similar reaction locally to what we saw to the Senate bills expressing gratitude. I don't think it's a coincidence that the two Republicans that make up, that are included in Mecklenburg's legislative delegation are the ones taking the reins on this. The local Democratic leadership are well aware that they are not exactly the popular kids in the General Assembly, and they certainly want people like Senator Sawyer and Representative Cotham at the forefront of this in order to give it a chance. That being said, Senator Sawyer has maintained that it's really a jump ball and it remains that, that there's a lot of work that remains to be done. And like you said, this would certainly set up, if we can even get to the point where they need to reconcile these two bills, it would certainly be an interesting discussion.
You're right. That would be a good problem for them to have. The Board of Education held a public hearing on the new CMS budget this week, and residents urged the school system to aim higher, particularly on teacher pay. Speakers at the meeting said higher pay for teachers is crucial, even in an uncertain year like this one, when state and federal funding is tighter than usual. Here's local resident Sandra Diaz.
I don't envy you the situation you're in, sandwiched between increasing costs and decreasing revenues. But this is where I think the county is going to need to step up. What we've got is a situation where both the state and the federal government are hostile to public education.
James, CMS's proposed budget, as I think you reported this week, is $2.1 billion, including a $667 million request from the county. So where does that leave teacher pay?
So teacher pay right now, the current budget as proposed, includes a 5% increase to the local teacher supplement, which is paid through Mecklenburg County. So that would be part of that $667 million request for the county. This has been up for debate at the school board over the last several meetings. Board member Summer Nunn in particular has called for a higher teacher supplement. And certainly it's been a conversation recently. The League of Women Voters held an event on school funding on Monday where there was a lot of talk about this. You know, if we can't rely on the state and the federal governments to increase teacher pay, we have to ask more from the county. And that's what you've been hearing a lot from public school advocates. But, you know, right now that number is at 5%. It includes a little bit extra for teachers who have been working for more than 15 years, because you'll hear a lot of teachers talk about how at the state level, the pay scale kind of gets stagnant after 15 years. And that was something that locally they were hoping to address. But yeah, we kind of touched on there, it's tight. So it'll be interesting to see if this gets, you know, changed at all.
In other CMS news, the school calendar for 2026-27 has been adopted. School will start on August 25th. Go ahead and mark your calendars now. But some local and state leaders want state law changed so that school can start earlier than that. CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill said the district will reconsider the school calendar if the law changes.
The elephant in the room, obviously, is potential changes to calendar law. But at this time, the calendar that we've presented is in alignment with the current legislation. And if any changes are made, we will go back and revisit.
So, James, current law requires schools to start no earlier than the Monday closest to August 26th. What does the board prefer? What's the general sentiment?
Generally speaking, a lot of school districts across the state have been advocating for an earlier start date. A lot of people want to align with their local community college calendar. The goal here is to try to line it up so that the semester ends right before the winter break, because a lot of times you kind of have like some time after that, and people say that it doesn't give the kind of break that you're looking for, because you have to prepare for finals and stuff and things like that. So that's something that has been, you know, up for debate in schools for a long time. And in fact, a lot of school districts across the state kind of just openly ignore the law and start earlier. Obviously, CMS has not been one of those school districts to do that. And this is a law that has been debated, or an idea that has been debated for a long time. It gets a lot of pushback from the tourism industry that wants the summer to kind of extend a little further. But the preference would be to start earlier to try to align to end the semester on that winter break.
So it's August 25th, 2026, unless it changes.
Correct. Yep. And there is a bill right now that was introduced recently by Senator Berger and others in the Senate that would create a second option for schools to start the Monday closest to August 19th. But with that bill also would come greater accountability measures for districts that are ignoring the law or not following the law exactly. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
We should just start school at the beach. That would make everybody happy. Still more CMS news. The continuing fallout from a March incident at Ardrick Hill High School was back in the spotlight this week. At Tuesday's school board meeting, residents called for the district to re-examine the case in which a 15-year-old Muslim girl was injured in an altercation with a black male student. More than a dozen attendees spoke out against the incident, calling it an example of Islamophobia. Some called for an independent review and for members of the Ardrick Hill administration to be fired. Ardrick Hill student Miriam Zini, who said she's a friend of the girl, said the school ignored bullying behavior leading up to the incident.
CMS does not protect students like me assaulted in the hallways of my own school, where I should feel safe and protected. However, I feel like it is only a matter of time before such a violent incident happens again.
A day earlier, on Monday, the NAACP held a news conference at the Government Center. President Corinne Mack accused the girl's supporters of making misleading and inflammatory statements about the incident and the NAACP's involvement.
Every statement that has been made intentionally, and those statements are causing a racial divide between the black and Arab community, something we do not need.
And Mack said the NAACP isn't taking sides, but wants the rhetoric toned down. So, James, I'm going to start with you. What are the likely next steps here, if any?
You know, it's tough to say. The girls' supporters are continuing their calls for a further investigation. You know, they held their own press conference last week denouncing the fact that the CMPD had come out and said there was not enough evidence for a hate crime. So it doesn't seem like those efforts are going to slow down anytime, you know, soon. CMS, I did reach out to them asking if there was going to be any further investigation, had not heard back yet. But I know that there had been calls for CMS to release surveillance footage of the incident, and CMS has been pretty adamant that they're not planning on doing that, citing student privacy laws. So it's tough to say whether this is going to be something that CMS continues to look at, but certainly with the school board meeting on Tuesday, it doesn't seem like the calls for more to happen are going to stop anytime soon.
And I think that both the students were suspended after the incident.
That's right. Yes, they were both. We've been told by the families involved and the spokespeople involved that both students were suspended for 10 days.
And is there any other discipline likely, possible?
Yeah, it's not really clear at this point. And again, with the student privacy elements here, CMS really has not said a whole lot at this point.
And you mentioned the surveillance video. I think both sides in this argument about what happened have called for that release. But as you said, student privacy is being cited by CMS. This is not likely to happen.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, at least that's what we've heard so far. Whether that will change as kind of this continues to play out in the public eye, you know, unclear. But at this point, CMS has said that they don't intend to release the footage.
Ben, I'm curious, political aspect. I mean, not technically political, but everything's political. For a superintendent and a school board, you know, what kind of lasting impact, what kind of concerns are there beyond what actually happened?
I mean, this is a really nuanced, complicated issue. You have an issue that's pitting two marginalized groups against each other, a school community there. You have the Black and Arab community. two communities that often find themselves on the same side of issues, often allies when it comes to some of these issues, now having dueling, competing press conferences, which we really have not seen in recent memory. And you have a 15-year-old Muslim girl and a Black male student with competing narratives about what they saw happen. It's bringing to the fore issues that don't often come up, and a superintendent or a school system that probably is grappling with the best way to handle it.
And the girl's family is upset in part that CMPD and the FBI have said this is not a hate crime from everything they can tell, correct?
That's correct. Based on anything in our reporting, CMS consulted with CMPD, consulted with FBI, all came back. No evidence of a hate crime. That's not stopped some of the calls for further justice, but at least for the time being, from a legal standpoint, or a criminal standpoint, it certainly has.
And this may be a dumb question. All my questions may be dumb, as a matter of fact. But, you know, there's this discussion about the surveillance video. I am making the assumption, I don't know if it's a safe assumption, that even though it's not being released, you would have to think that it was reviewed as part of trying to determine what happened. Do we know that?
Yeah, the girl's family has said that her brother and her father reviewed the footage at the school after the incident. That's part of why they've been calling for it to be released. They say that it shows that, you know, this was kind of a one-sided attack, and that's one of the things that have been driving it. So they have said, the girl's family at least has said, that this video exists and it has been reviewed by them.
Got it. Okay. And so we expect to hear more. We just don't know when or exactly what is going to be requested from here.
That's right.
One final piece of education news. Registration for pre-kindergarten opened in late January, and officials said more people are applying earlier than in past years. As of March 24th, MEC Pre-K had received 1,700 applications, easy for me to say, 1,700 applications in 9 weeks, up 39% compared to the same time in 2022. Mary Margaret Cantor, Chief Early Education Officer at Smart Start of Mecklenburg County, said that some of the spike in early applications can be credited to an ongoing rebound from the pandemic, but she said it's also because of concerns about lost ground in literacy.
The fear of this, you know, the falling behind phenomenon and all of that. I think that's gotten so much press that I think some people have tuned into that and are aware of helping their child get started as early as possible.
And James, given that, which is mostly good news, that more people are applying and applying earlier, any concerns about capacity with this surge?
Yeah, there's absolutely concerns about capacity here. And Mary Margaret Cantor did tell me she would love to be able to serve everybody. But there is a limited number of seats. And if you're applying, if you're applying to this and don't get a seat, you will be waitlisted. And it's something that they would love to see more of, more seats available. And certainly, I mean, this has been all over the news and education, this concern about this kind of falling behind phenomenon that she mentions there. I mean, we saw a couple months ago the National Assessment on Educational Progress test, which measures reading and math scores in fourth and eighth graders, had shown national declines in reading. And then locally here at CMS as well, CMS has talked about this a lot because it's one of the goals that the district set to increase literacy scores in K through 2, which then obviously implicates pre-K 2. So that would kind of explain, you know, where maybe people are getting this idea that they need to get started earlier and try to prevent this that has been so publicized lately. But certainly capacity will be a concern. It'll be interesting to see if that's something that comes up as Mecklenburg County begins to look at its budget, if there's any room there for growth, in terms of whether or not that's something that's actually being moved on, I'm not sure. But, it'll be interesting to see.
So you said goals. Speaking of goals, the president of FIFA, Gianni Infantino, paid a visit to Bank of America Stadium to promote the FIFA Club World Cup matches coming here in June. But David Tepper, who happens to own the stadium and the MLS and NFL teams that play in that stadium, took the opportunity to put Infantino on the spot for women's World Cup matches in 2031.
Speaking to some of my FIFA friends here, we're talking about how Charlotte has a stake in the ground. And in 2031, there will be the Women's World Cup. And they're well aware now, there's no mistake, that Charlotte is an international soccer city. And particularly one of the major places in the United States, if you're having a match like that, you have to come to. So I don't know if I'm going to might have to hold them to it. But in 2031, we'll see what happens, and we'll have some of those stars, hopefully, in the Women's World Cup.
So, Hunter, I was going to let you weigh in on this, but just say yes or no. Is it coming?
We will see. We are a hot candidate.
There we go. That's what Johnny Infantino himself said. I want to thank Hunter Sines, Mary Ramsey, Ben Thompson, and James Farrell. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Have a great weekend, everybody, and thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.